There is no military solution in Libya. The only solution has to be a political solution. And with all the difficulties in taking the LPA, the Libyan political agreement, the Sakhirat agreement, and implementing it, and nevertheless, it's the only tool that we've got. It's the only option that we've got.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Ben Pauker, FP's executive editor for the web, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Brussels today, and I'm joined by Ambassador Mohammed Abushahab, Jost Hilterman, and Colin Kahl. Mohammed Abushahab is the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Belgium and the EU. He was previously director of policy planning at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation of the UAE. Jost Hilterman is the Middle East and North Africa Program Director at the International Crisis Group, leading the organization's research, analysis, policy prescription, and advocacy in and about the region. And Colin Kahl is an associate professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service. He is also a strategic consultant for the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. In January 2018, he will join the faculty at Stanford University as the inaugural Stephen C. Hazy Senior Fellow in the Freeman Spohley Institute Center for International Security and Cooperation. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. If you've got an episode ideas or comments, email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com.
Welcome, listeners. We have a special edition of the ER today. We're not actually in our tiny podcast studio high above DuPont Circle, but on the 25th floor of a hotel in Brussels, where I have the privilege to be joined by these three, discussing, in the heart of the European capital, discussing some issues of great importance to the global community. We just finished up a peace game, which is a special event that FP does. This was our eighth one discussing Libya. And so I thought we would have a little bit of a discussion about that and some of the regional complexities. And then, because it's going to be in the news, I'd like to turn and we'll have a little talk about what we foresee as some of the complexities regarding the Iran deal with what seems to be Trump's imminent decision to decertify the deal. But because we're in Brussels, not Washington, I think this is a unique opportunity to talk more broadly about some of the issues regarding Libya and some of the issues regarding both of these regional crises. Too often, I think, even at Foreign Policy, we present the sort of the U.S. context or the what the Trump administration will do, what the State Department thinks of X, Y, or Z. It's a unique opportunity for us to go a bit broader and think a little bit about how other governments in Europe is approaching this. So, Mohammed, I'd like to begin with you. Can you give us a little bit of an appreciation for the current climate in Libya right now? Too often in the U.S., it's only thought of as a security crisis, an imminent home for ISIS and terrorism, but the political issues are much broader.
Thank you, Ben. I think, you know, first off, perhaps I should talk about why we should care about Libya and why does the UAE care about Libya. Libya is can be a very wealthy country with lots of natural resources. It's a large country that can, if left to spiral further out of control, can have huge impact, spillover, negative effects on many of its neighbors. And it already is having some effects, not just its neighbors on the south, but also its neighbors up north in Europe. It is a country that has whose people for far too long haven't enjoyed stability and prosperous development and good governance. And after the fall of the Gaddafi regime has been open to being hijacked by extremist groups. And for the UAE, we see that too many examples of regional instability in our region festering and then creating space for further problems. So, you know, we should all care about Libya, care about getting it towards a political solution so that these problems, whether it's migration, extremism, or, you know, social economic problems for the Libyan people, so that we can help or play our part in resolving it. And if we want to stay away from this or just to manage the problem, it's just a matter of time, as we see from terrorist attacks, from other events. It's just a matter of time before we will have to be pulled in. So, you know, we are glad that we were able to have this discussion here in Brussels.
Joost, Mohamed mentioned the migration and security issues, but maybe you can give our listeners a quick lay of the land with regard to the political talks, the peace process, and the different actors.
Thanks, Ben. Let me start this way. To the Libyans, from the ground up, their country is a disaster, but they still consider it their country. There is still a Libyan identity that's very important. We have seen huge migrant flows through Libya, but we haven't seen many Libyan refugees, actually, until now, fortunately, which suggests that there is still a basis for coming to some kind of solution. But the problem of the Libyans, and they are deeply divided, especially after the lid was taken off Libya through the removal of the regime in 2011, and the weakness of political institutions under the previous regime, under Gaddafi. Now, people are basically competing for resources, and they're using everything at their disposal. Political leaders use militias, and it's everyone against everyone. And to find a solution in this is extremely difficult. From the regional perspective, as the ambassador says, it's also very frightening because there are a number of conflicts in the region and they are multiplying. And these countries that have until now are outside of the crisis are trying to protect themselves, but are actually also contributing to the crises. And then you get to Europe, especially in the case of Libya, to a lesser extent the United States, which are looking from outside and are also affected by the crisis because of the migrants and the terrorism threat, and are overreacting in many cases or pursuing an overly securitized response that doesn't address the real problems that are going on in Libya. In this context, the UN has been asked to come and facilitate a political solution that is Libyan-led. And this has proven to be very difficult. But 2 years ago, an agreement was reached among some of the actors. It sounded inclusive, but it was actually not inclusive of some of the key power brokers. And they have become spoilers since then. So for the last 2 years, we've seen that this agreement, the Libyan political agreement, has faltered. But again, because there is still this Libyan identity, and because there's no single actor that can prevail over others militarily, it hasn't gone away. And now we have a reinvigorated attempt by the UN to address this and to see if this can be fixed, if this agreement can be fixed, and especially if some of the main actors that were spoilers 2 years ago and in the past 2 years can still be brought together. And that's the real challenge we face. But if we don't do it, then the migrant flow will continue because it's privatized and militias are just basically becoming people smugglers. And European countries are willing to pay these militias in order to stop the migrant flow, but then it just shifts to other militias that are not paid off. Everybody starts raising their price. So it's a business, and it's a very dirty business. People are the victims of it. But I still have some hope because people do still accept that there is a political process. And people the violence hasn't had reached the level and the generality throughout the territory that people have started leaving in great numbers. So we need to work from that basis.
Colin, it seems to me that Libya, for some reason, has remained off the radar screen of most Americans. And it wasn't a place where the Pottery Barn scenario held. It wasn't you break it, you bought it. The U.S. famously led from behind, but it was clearly a powerful player in toppling the Gaddafi regime. You spent time in the Obama administration. Maybe you can give us a little insight as to why the problems inherent to Libya were so vexing for the White House.
Sure. Well, look, I think initially, separate and apart from the leading from behind comment, the...
Who said it?
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't in the White House at the time. No, seriously, I don't know. And I guess even if I was, I couldn't tell you. Look, I think there was an expectation. President Obama has been explicit about this in some of the interviews that he gave toward the end of his tenure, that at least he had the expectation that the Europeans were going to take more of a lead in the aftermath, and that there was also some fundamental constraints about how much the Libyans actually wanted the international community on the ground. So I think, from the very beginning, the Obama administration was willing to provide a lot of critical enablers and military support for initially the civilian protection mission, which morphed, as they sometimes do, into essentially a regime change mission, that the hope was that the post-war situation would largely be handled by those European stakeholders with the most track record and experience on the ground, the UK, the French, the Italians and others, and the international community didn't show up in the way that I think many in the Obama administration hoped. And then also, like I said, there was not a lot of appetite for a large presence, especially a militarized presence by the international community among the Libyans in the immediate aftermath. I will say that at least in my time in the White House, which was really the last 2.5 years of the administration, Libya was seen as the dog that wasn't yet barking on the Islamic State front, but was about to. That is, there was a recognition that it was the third most lethal branch of the Islamic State, and that as ISIS was being squeezed in Iraq and Syria, that there was a real possibility that they would relocate to Libya. And we actually saw in the kind of 2015-2016 context some reverse flow. Traditionally, Libya has been a source of foreign fighters flowing to the Levant and to Iraq. We started to see a reverse flow back into Libya. We started to see ISIS deploy some of their more experienced leadership and commanders into Libya. We started to worry about the possibility that they would use safe havens in places like Sirte to essentially engage in external plotting against the United States homeland and against Europe. And so shortly after the stand-up of the Government of National Accord, we worked through Prime Minister Sarraj and through Misratin militias, essentially in support of this Government of National Accord, to pretty aggressively go after ISIS's presence in Sirte and do them a lot of damage. But I do think it speaks to this issue that from the American perspective, we have largely seen Libya in the post-Qaddafi era through a counterterrorism lens, and it's always seemed to be kind of second, third, fourth in line. But I think that's going to change, because you have the Islamic State essentially on the ropes in Iraq. The only place they're left in Iraq is basically along the border in Al-Qaim. In Syria, they're being squeezed in Raqqa, and the last stand in Syria is going to be in the middle Euphrates River Valley around Deir ez-Zor and Abu Kamal and some other places. But the days of the territorial caliphate in Iraq and Syria are numbered. And so I think you will likely see more of an emphasis on Libya. I would caution the Trump administration, though, to take a purely CT lens towards this problem, because it's not, I think one of the things that our conversation today surfaced is that not only is securitizing the issue dangerous because there's a broader set of economic and political considerations, but actually the expediency of seeing Libya through the lens of counterterrorism can create the temptation for certain actors to partner with actors on the ground inside of Libya that they perceive as short-term, in the short term, useful against a common enemy, so a kind of enemy of my enemy is my friend logic, when it's possible that some of these militia can be spoilers in the overall equation. So I think one of the things that was surfaced through our conversation today is just how important it is that all forms of assistance that the international community provide be channeled through the legitimate authorities of the GNA, of the Government of National Accord. The 800-pound gorilla in this equation is really what you're going to do with General Haftar and the the Libyan National Army, which is neither a national thing nor really an army. It's not national in the sense that it's largely an eastern a coalition of Libyan forces, and it's not an integrated army in the sense that it's a kind of hodgepodge of militias under the control of Haftar. It is true that it is the most powerful military entity on the ground in Libya. It's also the case they're not powerful enough to take over the whole country, and they have not bought into the Government of National Accord. And so I think there has been a temptation over the last several years, especially among some regional partners who view the Islamist terrorist challenge very broadly, to see Haftar as a useful, expedient ally in that equation, because he's gone after Islamists kind of systematically, even if acting through him works to the detriment of the Government of National Accord. So I think that I hope that the international community now understands that whatever they do on the counterterrorism or political or development front really needs to be channeled to the degree possible through the institutions that we're trying to build at the core of the new Libya.
You know, part of this is that Libya was an invented state held together by Gaddafi, with tribal regimes, vast expanses of wasteland and desert, Tuaregs and migratory peoples, many tribes. And now there's this intense effort to build an inclusive governance structure. Mohammed, how are some of the outside political actors from the Middle East and other places helping to make sure that everyone has a say who needs a say without alienating groups so that they take up arms and break the state again?
I mean, look, for the UAE, we've been advocating this for years now, that there is no military solution in Libya, that the only solution has to be a political solution. And with all the difficulties in taking the LPA, the Libyan Political Agreement, the Sakhirat Agreement, and implementing it. And nevertheless, it's the only tool that we've got. It's the only option that we've got. So we have been advocating for and trying to facilitate Libyan-Libyan dialogue. And, you know, this political solution can only be reached by the Libyans. They do have to include those that feel that the agreement hasn't met their needs. They do have to get everybody on board. And what the UN envoy with the new action plan that he's put forward in September need to do is get all of these parties to agree on a way forward on the LPA. We don't see any other alternative, so we're throwing our full support behind the UN envoy.
Jos, do things have to get worse before they get better? There are so many rival groups and camps that hold territory, that have militias, and may not agree to this reconciliation plan. Is there enough leverage for UN envoy Ghassan Salami to bring parties together in a way that can be constructive and find a lasting solution?
Well, there's no question that the challenge will be huge for Ghassan Salami as he has taken on this position and this role. He is going to try to amend the Libyan political agreement and to take care of some of the flaws that were there originally. The original agreement, while providing a basis, was also rushed and left out because of that some key actors, as I mentioned. And I think his objective is going to be to restart the talks in a way that is more inclusive, and to try to bring more people around the table, first through meetings focused specifically on recasting the Presidential Council, which now is 9 members, but may go down to 3 members or something like that. We'll have to see. And then to create some of the other key institutions to govern, and then to have the parliament, the legal parliament, to endorse that. Because that happened sort of 2 years ago, but not the leader of the parliament did not agree, but the majority of the parliament did. But the leader of the parliament, of course, was powerful and therefore a spoiler. And then to organize a national convention, which is really a big tent exercise, even though we haven't really heard the detail of it yet. But that would focus on some of the key questions that cannot solve through elections or even in a constitutional committee, but have to be done by a larger group, and they include the issue of decentralization, resources, because of course Libya is heavily dependent on oil exports, the minorities, and especially, and it's the most difficult one, is how is the military organized? Can you bring all the militias together under a single umbrella, under a single command structure that is then under civilian control? Is it possible? The challenge is extremely difficult, but there is no alternative, because the alternative is that the situation can get worse. It can come to open fighting, and then when that happens, I think you will see not only migrant flows through Libya, but also refugee flows, and you'll see also an increase in violence that will spread beyond the borders of Libya and affect the surrounding states.
Colin, is there any precedent that you can think of a political solution of this magnitude? I can't off the top of my head think of a state that's so fractured that has been able, at least in the modern period, to be put back together.
One does not immediately come to mind, and it's fractured in all sorts of ways. There's a regional fracture, east, west, and south, but even that, in some ways, puts on top, creates an illusion of certainty, or that there are groups that are aligned with eastern tribes that reside in the west, or in the south, and vice versa. You also have entities like Misrata that are essentially city states. You have competing government centers in Tripoli versus Tobruk. And so you just have a lot of different actors. And as Jost pointed out, as flawed as the political agreement and the political track is under the LPA, the Libyan political agreement, and obviously the UN is trying to patch that up, it's way ahead of the security track. And there are so many actors that have to be integrated and reconciled, or isolated and demobilized, and it's not exactly clear how that's going to happen. And I made reference to Haftar earlier. The one of the big questions, maybe the $64,000 question in this, is who's going to be the supreme commander of whatever reconstituted national army is going to be, and what role does Haftar play in that? Is it a selection of commanders that is done completely internally, just that you stand up a military and then they select their own, or should there be civilian oversight and control over how military commanders are approved of and released from their duty if necessary? That's clearly the preference, I think, of the vast majority of the international community, but it runs runs up against the interests of some of the more powerful actors on the ground. And that's just inside Libya. You then layer on top of that the fact that the international community, while united in the sense of being concerned about Libya and the spillover consequences of Libya for the region, for the counterterrorism problem, for the migration issue, has no baseline agreement about which actors to back. And so because you have competing patrons for the different sides, it's especially hard because it's difficult to marshal international consensus to put leverage on all of the actors. I do think that while we should caution, you know, the cautionary note I made earlier about over-securitizing the Libya situation or seeing it just through a counterterrorism lens, it is one of the few issues where you might be able to get a degree of consensus. And if you can get the Americans and the Russians and the French and the Italians and the Egyptians and the Emiratis and others to understand that the common concerns they have about terrorism can only be reconciled by all of them putting pressure on the various actors that they have the most influence with on the ground to actually make real progress on the security track. And by that I mean not just getting guys with guns to go after other guys with guns, but actually to integrate and to be professionalized and, if necessary, demobilized, and having the hierarchy of command and control rationalized and under the GNA, the Government of National Accord. If you can get agreement on that basic issue, then maybe you can get enough pressure on the militias on the ground. But I don't know that there's, I mean, the sheer complexity of the and numbers of actors combined with how many foreign parties are relevant with conflicting interests is, if not a unique challenge historically, is among the more unique ones.
Well, I don't want to leave listeners on too much of a depressing note, because part of the reason that we do Peace Game is to bring people together to explore constructive solutions for these kind of problems. Mohammed, you seem to have a certain sense of hope that there can be a solution here.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no doubt that while Libya is very, very complex, the solution seems to us like it's still within reach. That being said, we always feel like we come close in Libya and that solution is just, you know, out of our reach. We are deeply concerned by the terrorist threat and the safe haven that they're finding there, and the organized crime businesses that fuel and support the migration challenge. We do feel that while the political process needs to be moved forward and supported and facilitated by the UN envoy and the international community, and that all actors who do have any influence in Libya should use that influence to try to get these actors to come to a political agreement, the counterterrorism threat cannot wait for it. So we feel that the international community needs to work with the Libyan people even while the political solution is out of reach, and in parallel, supporting the Libyan GNA and the LNA, the Presidency Council, in confronting this threat. Because it will and has and will continue to make the political solution even harder to attain, and the threat will continue to grow while that political solution remains out of reach. So we're thinking of ways with our partners on how we can support the Libyans in the meantime to confront the extremists.
Well, I just want to come in on that, if that's okay, because what Mohammed, Ambassador Abu Shahab said is very important, that you have a political process that is going to have to take time. If it's rushed again, it will not lead to greater stability, but further breakdown and despair. But you also have immediate security threats. You can have a bomb attack in some European city that originates in Libya or is seen to originate in Libya.
The Manchester bomber.
That usually, because of the need to appease local publics, leads to an immediate response that can be unilateral. I think the UN envoy, in this case Ghassan Salame, faces the critical task, as did his predecessors, to hold on to a political process that is not undermined by unilateral actions by states or non-state actors that are responding to security threats, but that everything still is coordinated with him and with the UN, so that he can combine both the short-term requirements with the longer-term term ones, so that one doesn't undermine the other. I think that is the real challenge that the UN mediator faces, and it's again not an easy one. But if what we have seen often in peace processes, including in Libya, is that unilateral steps, if there's no strong coordination from the UN coming in with the support of the international community, then you end up with unilateral steps taken. And we've seen that the European states, member states of the EU, are working directly at cross purposes in Libya.
Well, speaking of unilateral moves, I want to take a little jump and take 10 minutes at the end of the podcast to discuss what seems to be an inevitability, and that's the Trump administration's decertification of the Iran deal. We're here in Brussels today, and I can't imagine European governments are particularly thrilled about this move. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the White House is going to throw out all parts of the Iran deal, but it does set us down a course that looks to be in potential conflict, or at least an attempt to gain additional leverage over Iran. So I want to get some thoughts on what this means for the deal itself, how the White House is going to play this, and how some of the other governments will act.
So let me start, maybe. I think one thing for the listeners to understand is that the deal qua deal is working. That is that the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was meant to put significant and verifiable constraints on Iran's nuclear program, in particular to make it difficult for them to produce the explosive fissile material you would need for a nuclear weapon, either through weapons-grade uranium or weapons-grade plutonium. The deal has all sorts of stringent constraints on Iran's program in that scheme. And the International Atomic Energy Agency, who's the UN watchdog in charge of verifying compliance with the deal, has reported 8 times that Iran continues to comply with the deal. And Trump's own cabinet, Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster, Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, have all concluded that agree that Iran is in technical compliance with the deal. But Trump hates the deal. And there's this law that was passed in the summer of 2015 by Congress called INARA, which stands for the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. And it was passed on a bipartisan basis as a way to review the deal that was about to be finalized to give Congress a voice. And what the legislation calls for is that every 90 days after the deal, the president has to certify a number of things, principal among them that Iran continues to comply with the deal, but also that the deal, and especially continuing to lift sanctions under the deal, continues to be in the U.S. national security interest. So what Trump is coming at, I think the way they're going to try to split the baby on this is they may argue that Iran is violating the spirit of the deal, whatever that is, because Iran continues to be a troublemaker in the region. But Trump is likely to say, when he gives the speech in a couple days, that the deal simply isn't in America's interest. And what that does then is trigger a 60-day review process inside the Congress to consider whether to snap back or reimpose all the nuclear-related sanctions that were suspended under the agreement. Why is Trump doing this? Partly because he hates the deal. Partly, though, I think, is that his cabinet has tried to give him an option where he can express his hatred of the deal, but also try to generate international leverage to get the Europeans, the other members of the so-called P5+1, the permanent 5 members of the Security Council plus Germany, and Iran back to the table to discuss some of the issues that weren't covered by the deal, to include Iran's support for militancy and terrorism, its ballistic missile program, and to also lengthen the terms of the deal so that some of the constraints on Iran's nuclear program don't expire at years 10 or year 15. And they believe that essentially decertifying puts the world on notice that the deal is tenuous and that the Congress at any moment or the president could blow it up and then try to use that leverage to renegotiate the terms of the agreement. There are a couple of risks involved in this. The administration is signaling that they're going to decertify it, but they don't actually want Congress to reimpose all the sanctions and put the United States in material breach of the deal. The problem is the Trump administration has demonstrated no ability to actually control what Congress does. And so once they put this in Congress's lap, the only thing that needs 50 votes is the reimposition of sanctions. Everything else that you might do on Iran requires 60 votes. So the easiest thing for Congress to do is to reimpose sanctions and violate the deal. And so they could create a sorcerer's apprentice effect whereby they unleash a set of forces they don't control. Number two, even if that doesn't happen, Congress, to try to signal that they want a better deal, whatever that is, could pass legislation that in essence is viewed by the rest of the world as renegotiating the terms of the deal unilaterally. And you made the segue into this segment on unilateralism. And there, the real danger is we could increasingly be seen as at the very least, implementing the deal in bad faith and potentially being in material breach ourselves. And if the Trump administration is right that we should be doing more to isolate Iran in the region and internationally. And I agree with that. We should be doing more. The worst thing you can do is set in motion a set of unilateral actions that instead isolate the United States from our closest partners in Europe, and make and allow and basically do the impossible, which is allow Iran to play the victim in this equation. So if you want to pressure Iran outside the nuclear domain, I'm all for it. You want to isolate Iran, I'm all for it, but you're not going to do it by decertifying the Iran deal.
I'll just come from the UAE perspective. I mean, we were not part of the discussions on the nuclear deal, but we were the first country to congratulate Iran on signing the deal. And we understand that perhaps this was the best deal that was possible at the time. But regardless of what happens with this deal, we of course think it's important to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. But to be frank, our problems with Iran are, you know, that is one element of the many issues that we have on Iran, and it's not on the top of our list. On the top of our list are its destabilizing activities within our region, their activities in Syria and Iraq and Yemen and many other places. So, and one thing that we've seen as a result of the deal, I mean, our hopes from partners and hopes that we were skeptical about, but we would have been happy to have been proven wrong, was that by reaching the deal, that more wind would be in the sails of the relative moderates in Iran, and they would be able to influence these other files. In fact, what we've seen since the signing of the deal is that those forces have just been emboldened and they've wreaked even more havoc in our region. Now, we're not saying that there shouldn't be a deal, but what we're saying is that the preservation of the deal should not allow for Iran to have a free pass and to continue on this much more problematic behavior. And if there's a way to do both, we think that would be the best outcome. Do both as in preserve a deal that doesn't allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon, but also forces it to change its behavior.
Yost, by the end of the Obama administration, there wasn't a lot of love in the Middle East for that White House. Trump has been more favorably received, and particularly his strength when it comes to the Iran deal. But that also seems to go counter to a lot of European governments, and this might drive an even further wedge after the revocation of the Paris climate deal and other positions taken by the Trump administration. How do you see this playing out?
You know, this is very clear. I mean, the Trump administration is more closely aligned to those states that opposed the JCPOA from the beginning of negotiations, which were Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, and other Gulf states, because they saw that for them it was always a choice. Do you want a nuclear-powered Iran that can use its nuclear power to bully other states in the region, them, or do you want to have a denuclearized Iran, but that is empowered through a deal with the West? And that is, in the end, what has happened, of course, in their view. There is now a nuclear deal where the Iran's regional conduct was firewalled off in order to reach that deal successfully. But now they see that Iran is unleashed in the region, because now Europe wants to do business with it, the Russians, everybody else, even American companies, Boeing, others, are doing business with Iran. So from their perspective, the Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and others, Iran now can do whatever it wants in the region, because it feels that for the Trump administration now to get rid of that deal somehow, it will directly materially affect their interests in bringing Iran back into the international community and do business with it. So this is the real problem. The negotiations were between the P5 plus one on the one hand and Iran on the other, but it was really always between the United States and Iran. That's where the real disagreement was ever since the Islamic Revolution. And now the problem is that the deal is a multilateral deal. If one party, like the United States, or Iran for that matter, pulls out, you're going to have a major crisis, because other parties to the deal are going to balk. Now, the real danger is this. In this kind of situation where the Trump administration says the deal is politically, maybe Iran is not a material breach, but at the same time Iran is undermining it by its actions in the region, you can get to a situation where what we call black swans, or where one of the parties undertakes some military action, either directly or by proxy, and then incurs retaliation. And before you know it, you're in an escalatory cycle. I think under the Obama administration, every attempt was made to prevent that. And when there was an incident, for example, in the Gulf, to play it down and to immediately talk with the Iranians because there were channels. Now, the channels are not there, and the will is not there, and the extreme in both Iran and the United States are set to escalate whatever incident takes place, whether it be in the Gulf or in Yemen or in Iraq or in Syria or anywhere else where they face off.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. First, the deal itself was never meant to address Iran's other behavior. It was meant to get rid of the nuclear challenge for an extended period of time, perhaps in the hopes that Iran would moderate its behavior. But I sat in the Oval Office with President Obama multiple times where he made clear that in this case, hope was not a plan and that the deal had to make sense even if Iran didn't change its stripes at all, even if Iran continued to be the destabilizing actor that they were. And the reason that we prioritized the nuclear issue is that, I mean, look, I get that Iran's aspirations for regional hegemony spook other countries in the Gulf. They threaten U.S. interests. I think we should be worried about them. They concern Israel. But I think we have to put ourselves back into what the debate was like in Washington in 2009 to 2015, when everybody was saying that the most important issue was the nuclear issue, that Iran having a nuclear weapon was an existential threat to Israel, an existential threat to the United States.
We had a countdown clock on the website for the Israeli jets in the air.
Yes. Every day, I worked at the Pentagon for the first 3 years of the Obama administration. We spent as much time wondering about whether the Israelis were going to launch a war against Iran that was going to drag the United States in, or we would have to start a war to prevent them from acquiring a nuclear weapon. But my two biggest jobs at the Pentagon were ending the Iraq War and preparing for the Iran War. And it was solely because of the nuclear issue. There were also all sorts of talk about that if Iran crossed the nuclear threshold, that countries in the Gulf would follow suit, that the Saudis would develop their own nuclear weapons or acquire one from Pakistan, or that the Emirates would be compelled to pull out of the 1-2-3 agreement and militarize their nuclear program. I'm not saying any of this would have happened, but let's remember what the conversation was like in 2009 to 2015 when the deal was struck, where the nuclear issue or wars surrounding the nuclear program were the number one and number two concerns that people had. That said, Iran continues to be a bad actor in the region. I reject the notion that the deal has empowered them all that materially. They were bad actors before the negotiations. They were bad actors under sanctions. They were bad, and they're bad actors now. The Trump administration's own intelligence community professionals have testified to Congress that very little of the money from the deal has actually gone to the military. And the reality is, this stuff is cheap. All right, Iran only spends about $15 billion on its military. Saudi Arabia spends eight times that much. The Emirates spend probably twice as much as that. The Israelis spend 2.5 times as much. It's not about money. It's that the region is chaotic, and there are places like Lebanon and Syria and Yemen and Iraq where the Iranians have been good at exploiting chaos. That's not about money. And it's not about this Iran deal. So I would say, if you're worried about Iran's destabilizing behavior, let's focus on that. That means more security and intelligence cooperation with our partners in the Emirates, the Israelis, the Saudis, and others. It means more diplomacy, actually, to try to end conflicts in Yemen and Syria, the post-ISIS aftermath in Iraq, dealing with the controversies in places like Bahrain, to shrink the opportunities that Iran has. It means putting more sanctions. As long as those sanctions don't reimpose the sanctions suspended under the nuclear deal, we were always clear with the Iranians during negotiations. If you continue to test ballistic missiles, if you continue to export conventional arms and support terrorism, we're going to continue to sanction you, and we should. The last point I will make, if the goal is to put more pressure on Iran, risking blowing up the deal is the worst way of going about doing it. There are those proponents of blowing up the deal, you know, folks like Senator Cotton or people outside like the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Bibi Netanyahu and others, who basically say, no, we can reimpose all the sanctions. The United States is the biggest market in the world. We can dare every company and bank in the world. You have a choice. You can either do business with America or do business with Iran. The problem is our secondary sanctions, as potent as they are only as good as the underlying political consensus that underwrites them. And I'll give you one example. In the 1990s, we also had secondary sanctions on investments in Iran's energy sector, and the EU ignored them. In fact, they told their companies not to comply with them. And they dared the Clinton administration to start a trade war with them and claim that they would retaliate and take us to the WTO, et cetera. And the Europeans are saying the same things today. And the reason I bring that up is, even if you get, even if you reimpose all the secondary sanctions, you are never going to get back to where we were before 2015 because compliance will be uneven. The Chinese are going to continue to buy oil. So are the Indians. So are the Turks. So are the South Koreans. So are the Japanese. The EU is going to protect their companies. And you can't get 150% of this deal with less than 100% of the leverage we had before the deal. It makes zero sense. Instead, if you're worried about legitimizing Iran, the best way to legitimize Iran is to make the United States look like it's acting in bad faith, makes us look like the jerks, the skunk at the garden party, and allow the Iranians to play the victim. That is the pathway for Iran's legitimation, which is why, frankly, I think the Iranians are just sitting back and watching the Trump administration have an own goal here of creating divisions in the international community, because the Iranians know the only thing that puts pressure on them is when the international community is united.
Yeah, Rouhani has said almost exactly that. If the Trump administration dumps the Iran deal, the international eyes are going to be on Trump for doing so, and then Iran will figure out how to play it. But it strikes me that this is one place where a lot of goodwill and a lot of international cooperation is going to be very important, whether it is negotiating a new deal or increasing leverage on Iran to come to some sort of agreement here.
No, look, I think the only thing that brought Iran to the table was pressure. It was pressure from sanctions, and the UAE and many others, but the UAE played an important role in tightening up those sanctions and making them hurt. It came at a huge cost to the normal trade that we have with Iran, and we're, you know, more than willing to take that cost to get that pressure to compel them to come to the negotiating table. We basically need to have the same kind of pressure on other aspects. And I agree with Colin that it is possible to, whether it's through sanctions, whether it's through pushing back on some of the places that they've been having greater influence uncontested. But we need to take actions that does push back on, in fact, the other part of Iran that were not at the negotiating table. It is the Revolutionary Guard that are responsible for the files that bring us a great deal of concern. And it's not within, at least now, the space of President Rouhani or Minister Zarif. So we are looking and exploring ways now of what can we do to compel Iran to change its behavior, what kind of pressure can we bring to bear on Iran that would allow it to, or perhaps oblige it to change its destructive behavior in our region?
Well, I don't think those are questions we're going to be able to answer today, but they're right on point. Thank you again to my guests, Mohammed Abushahab, the UAE ambassador to Belgium and the EU, Joost Hilterman of the International Crisis Group, and Colin Kahl from Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service. And listeners, we'll see you again soon. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Ben Pauker, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us.